Hi, and welcome to the third season of the Holistic Matters podcast series titled The Holistic Approach to Pet Care. My name's Kara Cradle, and I'll be facilitating your audio journey into the world of nutritional support for pets, the importance of the endocannabinoid system for animals, and the unique components of the veterinary profession. I'm here with Jody Griffiths, who's been a certified veterinary technician for over 20 years. Let's get started. So we had a really great talk with Dr. Sue Howell and Dr. Ann Margaret Morgan. Had some really great insights from them. Jody, would you tell me a bit about them?
So I'll start with Dr. Sue Howell. Dr. Sue Howell has been a veterinarian for many years, and she actually was a mentor of mine. I credit a lot of the knowledge that I have today on the importance of nutrition in animals and really how nutrition plays a huge role in the health of animals. A lot of that information I credit to my time working with her. And Dr. Ann Margaret Morgan, I recently started working with as well, because she also has the same thoughts and the same ideas and the same passion for nutrition in veterinary medicine. She does a lot of different modalities in her practice. And so Dr. Sue and Dr. Ann Margaret are actually friends, and it's very cool to see the relationship between them, because obviously they both are veterinarians, but because of their friendship, they are able to bounce ideas off of each other, and they'll call each other every once in a while if they have a question about something, you know, just when they're looking for someone else's viewpoint on something that they're working on, or maybe a case that they're working with. And so it's very cool to see the relationship that they have between them. Both of them have expertise in integrative medicine, but they also have more individual expertises as well. Dr. Sue Howell recently opened her own practice. She's worked in multiple different practices throughout her career, but she recently just opened a practice that is very specific to her want to practice veterinary medicine in the way that she has found to be most beneficial. She has a little practice that is very focused on nutrition. She's an acupuncturist as well. And so her practice is very focused on really just doing that nutritional evaluation of the patient and helping to improve their health by using nutrition. Dr. Ann Margaret Morgan is very much more focused in canine and feline rehabilitation. She uses multiple modalities as well. She also is an acupuncturist, and she uses spinal manipulation, but her expertise is really in rehabilitation. She has a lot of information and a lot of knowledge on the nervous system in animals, and it was very cool to be able to spend some time talking to both of them, not only to see their friendship, but then also to get their expertise in their specific fields.
That sounds so great, and I'm so excited to hear what they have to say. To start us off, can you tell me a bit about why the nervous system is so important for pets like dogs and cats?
So as I was talking to Dr. Morgan about this question, she was talking about communication, high metabolic requirements, and the nervous system's need to generate energy. She was also talking about mitochondrial function and the energy production in the form of ATP.
And the mitochondria, of course, are the infamous cell organelles that are the powerhouses of the cell, as we all learned in high school biology. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And let's listen to what Dr. Morgan had to say about that.
Well, the nervous system, you know, it's a very, very important system, obviously, because it really governs the function for the entire body. And its main job is communication. And it has very high metabolic or energy requirements, and it requires pretty constant access to oxygen and glucose to generate that energy. And mitochondrial function is very important to the nervous system. Energy is generated in the mitochondria in the form of ATP. And this is the energy that drives our entire body and drives all our metabolic systems.
So why do polyunsaturated fatty acids, and sometimes we call them by their acronym PUFA, which is fun to say, why do they play such a large role in nervous system health?
You're totally right. PUFAs are important for nervous system health because cell membranes are important for the health of the nervous system. Cell membranes have a high concentration of lipids. Cell membranes also help the nervous system fulfill its key function of communicating through electrical signals. Dr. Morgan describes it like this.
The nervous system has a high content of lipid. We often think about high levels of DHA in the brain. We, you know, typically are aware of that and how important that is. But really, for nervous system health, a key component to nervous system health is health of the cell membrane. And the cell membrane contains a lot of lipid and polyunsaturated fatty acids. Because the nervous system does its job by sending electrical impulses or communicating with other organs, and particularly sending the signals through the endocrine system, it requires a healthy cell membrane, properly functioning membrane, to work. And so if there is issues with, you know, deficiency in polyunsaturated fatty acids, essential fatty acids, phospholipids, then potentially you could have, hypofunctioning of your nervous system, aberrant function, or pathophysiological changes in nervous system function.
So we've established that the nervous system needs PUFAs, which are not produced intrinsically for either humans or pets like dogs and cats. So they have to be consumed in the diet. But does the nervous system have other nutrient needs? And since I'm assuming you're going to say yes, why?
Just like a human, or a pet for that matter, who is extremely active, needs food to provide energy. The nervous system needs nutrients because it's constantly active, expending energy, and needing fuel. Dr. Morgan describes it in the context of metabolic activity, which I think is really interesting.
The nervous system, because it's so metabolically active, it requires large amounts of substrate in order to do its function through production of neurotransmitters and receptors. And so it's constantly recycling and requiring constant access to nutrients. So it's because of its high metabolic activity, it has a large need for substrate in the form of amino acids, minerals, B vitamins, and a lot of that must be obtained from the diet. Yeah, diet. A good diet is critical because protein would be very high on the list. That the animal is on good quality bioavailable protein because that's responsible for so many processes in the body. It's also amino acids, make neurotransmitters. And that's one of the keys to how the nervous system functions. So protein is very important. Obviously fat, as we just said, is going to be very important. And then, having the nutrients that be vitamins, for example, to run the metabolic pathways for nervous system function is going to be critical. And, they feel also because of the connection with the gut, the health of our biome and the bacteria in our gut also dictate and can influence the health of the nervous system. And that can be influenced through the diet as well. You could have problems with poor microbiome and a poor diet that may influence your microbiota. You can certainly supplement the diet with probiotics and things like that.
Very interesting. And I'll just throw in here that if any of our listeners are interested in learning more about digestive health and the microbiome, you can check that out on holisticmatters.com by hovering over the Discover tab and clicking on Digestive Health under Key Topics.
Always got to get that plug in for Holistic Matters. Yep. So much information there in one place.
That's right.
So next, I asked Dr. Morgan about the cell danger response, which you'll see sometimes as the acronym CDR. And for any of our listeners who are interested in learning more about that, there will be a link to a journal article on the podcast page for this episode, which can be found by going to holisticmatters.com and clicking on the podcast icon on the homepage.
Perfect. And let's hear how Dr. Morgan described the cell danger response.
The cell danger response is a healthy metabolic response that our mitochondria undergo in any situation of threat that may overwhelm our cells, overwhelm us as an organism that may threaten our survival. And this this response is protective. It acts to protect us. It downregulates energy production, and our mitochondria really go into a protective mode, an immune mode. They actually direct the immune system in that situation. If they feel that the threat, we need to activate the immune system and protect ourselves from harm. So a common example would be exposure to an infectious organism. When we have the flu, for example, viruses, we feel so tired. That's the cell danger response at play, lowering our energy production to, in a sense, outweigh and outlive the threat. And the mitochondria are also directing cell death and apoptosis, and all for the betterment of surviving this threat.
I'm imagining warning sirens going off in the body with a loud voice coming through an intercom saying, intruder, intruder, alert, alert.
Yes, exactly. Dr. Morgan goes on to describe a common example of the cell danger response being exposure to infectious agents like viruses. Think about how you feel when you have the flu, for example. Among other awful symptoms, you just feel exhausted, and that exhaustion is the CDR at play. The CDR pushes the body to reduce energy production to wait out the threat. And at the same time, mitochondria are directing apoptosis, which is this process of programmed cell death, all for the purpose of prioritizing where energy is utilized to survive the threat.
You know, your metabolism and your mitochondria can respond at a moment-to-moment basis based on circumstances both externally and internally. It is a natural response that when the threat is over, that the mitochondria then upregulate again and start producing energy.
So the body senses a threat, the flu or something else, and reacts in this way as directed by the CDR. What happens when the CDR doesn't resolve itself and mitochondria do not return to producing energy like normal?
Oh, that's a great question. I think I'll let Dr. Morgan explain this one.
However, there are times when potentially the cell danger response can get stuck if we have a prolonged threat, and that may take many forms, whether that be exogenously in the form of infection or EMF exposure, exposure to toxins, or endogenously that we have exposure to internal toxicity for a variety of reasons. Chronic inflammation certainly would be one, and any other sort of dysregulation really on multiple levels, because they feel that cell danger response and aberrations in this response can actually lead to aging and chronic disease and even cancer. So the cell danger response normally works very well. The problem is if we have some prolonged threat in any form, that this process gets stuck, and that's where that can become a problem for our nervous system, particularly our vagus nerve and our parasympathetic nervous system, because we are sort of stuck in a hole, which ultimately leads to further toxicity and deficit.
So to best support a healthy cell danger response, nutritional support is key.
Yeah, probably the most basic need and a good form of supplementation for mitochondria would be the B vitamins, because they act as cofactors in energy production, and they are very critical to so many metabolic pathways, and so B vitamins are a big one. Supporting the mitochondria with polyunsaturated fatty acids, omega-3s, phospholipids would also be very supportive to mitochondrial health. Antioxidants as well, certain nutrients, in particular CoQ10 and alpha-lipoic acid, they act directly at the level of the mitochondria as antioxidants in the electron transport chain. But we have in general antioxidants, things like resveratrol, green tea extract, bilberry, vitamin E, vitamin C can be very supportive to nervous system health and mitochondrial health.
So nutritional support is also important for high metabolic turnover. Can you describe what high metabolic turnover is?
Nutrient-dense foods in general, I think, would be supportive of high metabolic turnover. So whole foods, which are going to, which are very nutrient dense, are going to provide a wide variety of nutrients for the body. So that would probably be, best. Certainly, we talked about probiotics as a supplement, but fermented foods could be beneficial as well, as to promote a healthy gut terrain or healthy gut environment, and to support our healthy flora. When we have a leaky gut, it's surmised that we also have a leaky brain, in that our blood-brain barrier, it's been shown, can also be compromised. So our gut is linked very closely and very influential to nervous system health and brain health. So supporting the gut and keeping it healthy with a diverse diet, with a diverse biome, is going to be very important for supporting brain health.
So let's switch gears a bit and talk about the conversation we had with Dr. Morgan about rehabilitation, which she has a lot of expertise in. She's actually a certified rehabilitation therapist. So first, asking in general, what is rehab for pets all about?
Rehab is about restoring one's health, restoring the patient to his previous level of function. So it's really identifying, an individual's weaknesses or lack of function or problems, and then addressing that with various modalities to help restore it, whether that be recovering from a surgery or recovering from a chronic illness, recovering from cancer. So we look at the patient's function and their functional abilities. For a dog, can he get up? Can he do the stairs? Can he get in the car? For a cat, can she get in and out of the litter box? Can she get on her cat tree, do the stairs, those sorts of things. And then based on our findings, we do a pathofunctional exam, where we're evaluating function and identifying the problem areas, and then we design a treatment plan to address those areas.
So then I ask, say you finished an exam with a pet, and they clearly have some problem areas to address. Then what happens?
So if an animal has reduced, reduced mobility, perhaps reduced range of motion in a limb, or soft tissue restrictions, and we may address that with soft tissue manipulation or physical therapy techniques to relieve that. If they have pain issues, then we may use multiple modalities to address that, whether that be through supplementation, medication, various modalities such as acupuncture, spinal manipulation. I have laser therapy at my practice, shockwave therapy, and those are very good for decreasing pain and inflammation and to help stimulate a healing response.
And then, what can the pet owner do after they leave the clinic and take the pet home?
We do exercise routines for the animal to help them regain balance, coordination, strength, functional abilities. We have an underwater treadmill that we utilize in many situations. And then I'll design a series of exercises for them the owner can do at home. And then I'll monitor that, whether that be weekly, bi-weekly, or monthly, and then we may progress the dog or cat with their activities as they are progressing in their function. Well, it's been shown that electrical acupuncture, really, from a nervous system perspective, it acts on the nervous system at multiple levels as opposed to just dry needling. So when you stick a needle in an acupuncture point, you are stimulating the local tissue and inducing a reaction, endogenous release, opioid release. Endogenous opioids are released, and we're decreasing the local inflammatory mediators. The electrical acupuncture also acts segmentally at the level of the spinal cord, and that's acting on the dorsal horn neurons to release endogenous opioid. And then also, electrical acupuncture also acts on the brain, which we would call supersegmentally, and that is more of a inhibitory pathways, where inhibitory signals come down from the brain, down back to the dorsal horn to inhibit that pain response. So it has the benefit in that it's almost, you could talk about it as multimodal, because it acts on multiple levels and acts in differently at each level, which is really advantageous. And, you know, you're going to get a greater pain relief response with electrical acupuncture than you will with just using dry needles.
So then I asked, what are some ways that you can improve your chance of success with complex disease? And Dr. Morgan replied,
complex disease, chronic disease, you know, patients that have multiple body systems involved, multiple symptoms, that you have to sort of take a step back and look at that, do a thorough assessment of that animal as to what the deficits are, what are the, I always say, what organs are shouting the loudest in terms of need, because I think you have to prioritize in nutritional therapy what's going to be the biggest bang for your buck right now. And then you are constantly reevaluating as the animal as it is responding to the treatment that you implement, that the nutrient needs may change. So if your nervous system isn't working well, then, you know, utilizing a supplement to promote healing of his cruciate ligament is really, we're downstream, and we need to go back to where the, you know, original imbalance is, or very often that can be the gut. A lot of times we have to address gut function first, because in terms of nutritional therapy, they won't be able to digest and assimilate, and even more importantly, we also have to consider that animal's ability to detoxify, and keeping in mind that we are not, you know, exceeding their capacity to detoxify or respond. A critical animal, a complex disease patient, is going to have less reserve, less ability to respond. And so you may need to go more slowly, and you may need to utilize, maybe prioritize your supplements, maybe one at a time, and it may take more time for that patient.
I like how she emphasized returning to the part of the body where the imbalance is originating from. We talk about this a lot on holisticmatters.com and with a lot of thought leaders in our industry. The philosophy of identifying and addressing core visceral causes of issues as opposed to treating more surface level symptom-like issues.
Exactly. So we're seeing more and more canine cognitive disease in practice. And I think there are more dog owners that are experiencing it without knowing exactly what it is. I asked Dr. Morgan to explain what canine cognitive disease is and if there are ways to prevent it.
Canine cognitive disease is a neurodegenerative disease of the brain, which results in circulatory changes and microvascular hemorrhage and infarcts, which results in beta amyloid deposition. And dogs actually serve as a model for early stages of Alzheimer's in people. It's very similar. And we see in dogs, even as young as 8 years of age, are starting to develop cognitive symptoms. So for practitioners, it might be a reasonable thing, you know, to be proactive on a disease that can certainly be influenced, you know, nutritionally, to maybe implement a cognitive questionnaire for your patients over 8 years of age, and, you know, trying to identify the symptoms early, because I think a lot of owners just accept that as a normal aging, but in fact we can influence that nutritionally to help minimize or mitigate the symptoms, or maybe even prevent it if we're proactive early enough.
Very interesting. And there's also a link to a paper talking about canine cognitive dysfunction as a model for human age-related cognitive decline on Holistic Matters on that same podcast page we were talking about earlier. This condition sounds like it's something that dog owners may be experiencing with their pets without even realizing. So I think now might be a good time to transition to talking with Dr. Howell about her crime scene investigation metaphor. So, funnily enough, Jody, when I was reading over your discussion questions planned for Dr. Howell, I saw the acronym CSI, and I thought that it was some technical veterinary term that I just didn't know. So I sent you a message and asked what you meant, and you said it stood for crime scene investigation. And I was like, okay, okay, I get it. So how does Dr. Howell equate a pet patient exam to a crime scene investigation?
So So this is really an intriguing metaphor that Dr. Howell has illustrated, where the pet patient is a victim. And I'm putting air quotes around victim here. And whatever ailment or condition they're dealing with is the crime that veterinarians and pet owners are working together to solve, air quotes again.
I think this metaphor is super fitting because, frustratingly enough, our pets can't communicate with us directly using the spoken human language to tell us what's wrong. So the process of trying to figure out what's wrong with them definitely sometimes fits that CSI situation. Let's hear how Dr. Howell describes it herself.
The moment you walk into the room with a patient, you've walked into a situation where you're dealing with a victim, which would be the patient in front of you. You're dealing with a crime that's committed, and we name them different things. We could name them dermatitis, we could name them arthritis, but those are all crimes that occur to the system. And we're also walking into a situation where there has been a criminal that has been the perpetrator of the crime. So yeah, every patient is a crime scene. And you need to work as a detective to find out what happened, why, and how to caretake the victim as well as stop further crimes.
And there are four important components of this CSI metaphor that Dr. Howell describes as the four D's: diet, digestion, detoxification, and drainage.
Diet would be the very first one that is an issue with health problems. Food is everything. So diet would be number one. Digestion would be the second D. So pets that aren't digesting their foods properly have malabsorption, maldigestion, leaky gut, other problems from criminals in the environment, like toxins and heavy metals, chemicals, and just crap that's built up in their body over time. And that's a problem. Detoxification is a need to get rid of some of this garbage. But that's the third D. And the fourth D is drainage. In order to be able to get rid of garbage, you need to kind of open the windows up and air out the room first, because as you collect garbage, you sort of stir stuff up a bit. And a lot of these weak patients and these victimized patients aren't strong enough to be able to handle a stir up of garbage.
And can you explain just a little bit more about why diet is so important?
Absolutely. Dr. Howell describes how pets eat every day of their lives, just like humans do. So managing their diet as pet parents can be the most influential thing we do for them. Getting the right nutrients, enough nutrients, a variety of nutrients, and making sure those nutrients are being absorbed in the body is critical for balancing the body system. When it comes to digestion, the key is to successfully incorporate nutrients into the body.
What about detoxification? Why is it so important to remove toxins?
Great question. And Dr. Howell explains it like this.
We live in toxic environments, and toxicity is a problem in pets as well as people that creates different symptoms. You can be tired, you can be cranky, you can have skin problems. There's all sorts of myriad of conditions, even metabolic syndrome, and obesity, that can be a result of having a bunch of toxins in your body. And so I think when you look about detox, yeah, we all can benefit from detoxification, but it's the way that you do it and how to support the major organs of detox, which are the liver, the kidneys, and the lungs. And if those aren't working very well, you're gonna have to start working with the digestive tract and the skin. Those are the secondary detox organs, so you're going to have problems when you start detoxifying with some symptoms related to skin eruptions and things like that as you heal, and that's a healing process, not an indication of further disease. So we want to support healthy detoxification and not push the body beyond its physical limits. Yeah. And that's where the drainage comes in, because drainage is gentle detoxification. It's gently allowing the body to resume its natural processes while helping it cleanse itself of some of these toxins. So there's a difference. Drainage is gentle, and detoxification can be aggressive. And you can be aggressive even with whole foods.
She also talks about the particular signs she watches for while deciphering what an animal is dealing with health-wise.
Yeah, so the symptoms of detoxification can be many. And like I said, it has to do with some of these secondary organs, the digestive, the GI tract, and the skin. Main symptoms of detoxification would be increased thirst and urination, digestive problems all the way from constipation to diarrhea to gas to mucus in the stool, soft stools. You can have irritability. Pets can get cranky just like people. And a lot of times they'll retrace some of the symptoms that they've had getting to the point where they're at. So as it's like a journey back through time. They'll retrace some of their prior symptoms, which is kind of scary to a pet parent because they think they're getting worse when really what's happening is they're clearing out things and making a pathway out of their current situation into a better place.
I can definitely see how that could be scary for a pet parent. Like, is my dog reacting this way because he's getting better or because he's getting worse? I'm sure it's difficult to trust the process, which makes me wonder, how does Dr. Howell communicate with pet owners and let them know what to expect?
So here is how Dr. Howell describes it. She describes it very well.
When I talk to a pet parent about supplements or foods that I'm giving them to help encourage healthy detoxification and drainage, I tell them what's potentially going to happen. I'm going to tell them about those symptoms so that they can recognize them and see that they're not a negative, they're a positive. We just want to be able to keep the animal comfortable while that's happening, maybe back up a little bit and do it more slowly if necessary. So yeah, they understand what all of the symptoms are, and I lay it out for them. I have it even written down for them what they are and what to expect. And I found that people who understand that that's what's going to happen, they get really excited when those things do happen, as opposed to calling and saying that something's wrong. They'll actually allow that pet to have some of those symptoms for several days as they heal, and the symptoms typically improve, you know, over a shorter period of time, as long as you're allowing the windows to open and air out through some drainage.
So returning to the CSI metaphor a bit, I asked Dr. Howell about three qualitative investigative methods, beginning with the inquiry.
Inquiry would be the first one. So just asking questions of the owner of the situation with the pet at home, just getting some good history and understand what the diagnostics are that have already been done. So I do a lot of inquiry. I also look at observational findings on a pet, just how they move and how they act around me, how they have their body condition, and just observe them. And so that can be like one of the most powerful things to do, is to just really step back and look at them, because quantitative studies on blood work, et cetera, don't tell you the whole picture. You have to look at the pet because they're an individual. And yeah, you should be treating the pet and not the blood work.
And I heard that she also recommends food journals for pet owners.
Yeah. So just like a human might keep a food journal if they're having issues with food allergies or sensitivities, a pet owner can keep a food journal for their pet during the investigation of their digestive issues. Dr. Howell says a food journal for a pet would include any food that passes the lips of their pet in those 3 days. And that includes specific food brands, any human food consumed, treats, you name it. Interestingly, Dr. Howell is also certified in food therapy, and I really enjoyed hearing her talk about that.
Yeah, so Chinese medicine food therapy has been a real game changer for me in practice, because it's allowing me to help balance that pet's thermal energy, whether they're hot or cold or whether they're just neutral, according to how to feed them. So I'm trying to maintain balance, and I can look at their tongue. And this is part of the observational thing. It's observation, it's palpation too. So it's tongues and pulses and feeling their back and their ears. And are they warm? Are they cold? Do they like to sleep in warm places, cold places? Do they like to eat ice all the time? Or are they dogs? You know, there's all sorts of symptoms that can relate to the temperature of the pet. And when they're imbalanced, they're going to be out of homeostasis and have symptoms related to that. So, yeah, if a pet is running warm, then the best thing to do is feed them cooling foods. And if they're running cold, you would want to balance them out with warming foods. And every food has got energy. And so that's a lot of what I've learned from Chinese medicine is how to encourage the feeding of proteins, and especially, and different preparations of food to understand how to better balance that pet's thermogenic energy.
Awesome. I feel like with both Dr. Morgan and Dr. Howell, we got some really great insights from two experienced veterinarians with specific expertise and unique skill sets.
Yes, definitely. And next, I had the chance to ask them both about their general philosophy in veterinary practice, beginning with the advice that they might give to a new veterinarian that is just getting started in practice.
I think, you know, certainly I've been a veterinarian over 25 years, and I think, you know, one of the biggest things that you learn as a young new grad is that communication is really important. So communicating with your clients, that is really key, so that you're certainly educating the client on your findings and helping to help this pet. You're setting expectations, you're helping to guide them, you're supporting them. And I think, you know, that's one of the biggest things that I developed as a young adult, is you learn communication skills and how important that is in your job. From the aspect also of, this is such a emotional connection that the pet parent or owner has with their pet, and at times they're not always coming from a logical place, and so it's really important to help guide them and educate them, and, you know, talk with them so that they know, you know, what your plan is and what you can or, you know, can do, what you can do overall to help them. And I think also having a good work-life balance is really important. I think, you know, most veterinarians, most professionals in general, are very driven, and they want to help, and they want to do well, and they want to, you know, be successful, and you know, it's such a rewarding profession, rewarding and gratifying and fulfilling, but it can be overwhelming because we deal with a lot of good and bad situations at times, and so that can be very draining on you. So you have to look after yourself and be able to let it go and have quality time so that you can recharge and, you know, regenerate.
Well, I think self-care is huge, because if you take care of yourself, you have better energy for your patients and for your clients. I try to set an intention every day before I start work, and that intention can be whatever. It could be love, it could be, you know, just going slowly, it could be being attentive, it's whatever. But that intention has helped me absolutely focus on my patients and keep things real, and I know the pets feel that too. I also just try to be communicative with my pet parents, and with my treatments, I try to go, you know, gently with them and slowly into what the pet can handle, and not pushing them too hard, too fast, which is a struggle because we all want to see symptoms get better, and it's a symptom-focused profession. And understanding the healing process is a completely different story, because healing takes time, and you need to get into a more rested and relaxed state to do it. If you're in fight or flight all the time, and chronic inflammation is going to take over. So just trying to adjust the nervous system and, you know, caretake and understand that it's going to take time.
I think that's really great that she mentioned self-care and work-life balance, because we'll have an episode with Dr. Sheila Dodson this season about the realities of the veterinary profession and why work-life balance is so important for veterinarians.
Yes, I'm definitely excited about that discussion. Next, I asked Dr. Morgan and Dr. Howell how they set the practice apart from other practices in their area.
I have a different philosophy in my practice than the practices around me, in that I'm very committed to the client that's there with their pet at that time, meaning that I only see one patient at a time. And my mission statement would be that we're changing lives one pet at a time. And that means lots of things. You know, it means we physically only have them there one at a time, but we're also understanding that we're taking care of the individual. And when you're at my practice, you're the only one there. We've got all sorts of things to help calm and soothe and make it a nice place to be. There's no exam tables. We've got a lot of, you know, essential oils diffusing. We play music that's neurologically soothing to the pet. We don't wear lab coats. We don't force anything. And we have a lot of anxious pets that come in and they're not anxious anymore being at our place, which is nice. And plus, I've got a really nice location. It's on a river with a beautiful view. It's very soothing. So that's what I love about my practice.
I think certainly because I've been practicing for a number of years, I certainly... you know, I feel like I look at the animal as a whole and realize that everything is connecting to everything. So, you know, symptom in one organ system is not separate from a symptom in another organ system, and that all of that is connected. And so that we really have to look at that and evaluate that animal in that light. And I think, too, certainly as I've progressed over the years, in terms of addressing a patient and, you know, seeing patients, I think it's also, I really take into consideration the relationship between the pet and the owner, their relationship and their life as a whole, and how that, sometimes I'm addressing that as well, you know, what may be scientifically, therapeutically the best choice in the situation of that owner and their life with that pet, that may not be the one that overall is best for them. You know, you might be looking at and taking into consideration some of those other variables. You know, people and their pets, they really are one. They're closely connected, and what's going on, I think, in the owner's life is also impactful to the animal, and I think you need to take that into consideration as well. So I try to do that, I think too of, you know, particularly with geriatric medicine, and we see that a lot with people too. You know, as you get older, having this problem or that problem doesn't mean that we may always be aggressive to correct it, because you're really trying to find the less invasive path to supporting the health of that animal without causing other problems. I think sometimes in treatment, to address one problem, you create two new ones. And I think that, you know, experience and has shown, you know, as you see these patients over and over, that maybe that isn't always the best route or best approach. So you try to find the least invasive approach, taking into consideration as well what's going on in that owner's life and the pet's life, and what is doable, what is manageable, what might be practical, and what is most compassionate.
Can I add too? Just, I think both of us are also very nutritionally focused, which is very different than a lot of the practices around us. So you get kind of a more unique experience being able to understand the whole pet from the nutritional aspect, and that's a huge benefit.
And as we finished up the conversation, I was very interested in asking them about their relationship with each other and about what it's like knowing a fellow veterinarian who's a colleague and also a friend.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, as colleagues and friends, we support each other so much, both personally and professionally, in our day-to-day job and what we do. And I think that, you know, having a colleague that understands what we go through and to lean on, get advice from, vent, sort through, problem solve, you know, is wonderful to have. So I cherish the relationship, absolutely.
And I would second that. I think it's, we're super collaborative and we get really excited when we get together and talk and like it just learning, we're constant learners and it's really fun to be able to have someone else who's really passionate about a similar thing, but from a different perspective because I learn from Ann Margaret every time I talk to her and we just, I mean, personally do things outside of work, which is nice. And we learn how to caretake ourselves better. And we also share patients. I mean, we refer to one another, send people, I'll send my patients to her for rehab and other things that I don't know how to do. And she'll send some of hers to me for nutritional, more advanced nutritional stuff. So no, it's a great relationship. I would hope that all veterinarians could have this sort of collaborative friendship that's more than just on a professional level, but it's emotional, spiritual. It's just really nice.
I can totally see how having a friend who is also a veterinarian would be beneficial in multiple ways, like they described. I'm glad you asked that question, and I'm glad you interviewed them together, because I think that aspect was really important for the insights they provided during the discussion.
Yes, definitely. I totally agree.
Well, that's the end of our discussion with Dr. Sue Howell and Dr. Ann Margaret Morgan. We're so grateful that they joined us for this episode, and I hope that all of our listeners got as much out of this discussion as we did. We hope you'll join us next week as we continue the conversation on the holistic approach to pet care with a super intriguing chat with Dr. Slavko Komarninsky from the Plants for Human Health Institute in Kannapolis, North Carolina. We'll be talking about something that I'm sure will pique your interest, hemp and the endocannabinoid system.